The internet gives people the opportunity to build global audiences earlier than before. It doesn't really matter where you are if you have the internet. Singaporeans do speak English, which is a global language, so they could access a bigger market. What you say, though, about talent density is a real thing, which is like, let's say you're very promising, but you're not really surrounded by other promising people. It's hard to hone your craft, and that might require you to move elsewhere.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, Sierra founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. HD Mall is a healthcare marketplace in Southeast Asia connecting patients to over 1,800 medical providers. This covers multiple categories such as dental, aesthetics, and elective surgeries. Over 300,000 patients have accessed more affordable healthcare via HD Mall. Get yourself a well-deserved health checkup. If you're in Thailand, go to hdmall.co.th. If you're in Indonesia, go to hdmall.id. Hey, Shiyan, how's life?
Life is pretty good, Jeremy. How about yourself?
Still chugging along. We were just discussing about my fasting experience, and it's been quite a ride, to be honest. So, learning a lot about myself.
I know. Every time I eat something delicious, I think about you. And I have to. Should I text him? No, that seems mean.
I was walking home today, and I was like standing outside a bread shop, and he was talking about his 12-year approach to making longan bread recipe, blah, blah, blah. And I was like totally absorbed in reading this poster. So I was like, okay, you know what? I am pretty food conscious right now. So yeah, I'm glad you didn't send me photos. It would be torturous for sure.
Well, yeah. Every time I eat something delicious, I'm like, I don't know how he does it. It seems it's such a social experience eating, like separate from sustenance, just like being around other people eating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done a bunch of stuff on nutrition myself in the last year and a half. And so I do feel like I think about what I'm eating more than I did in the past.
Yeah.
But if I had to just be like, eat nothing for 10 days, I think I would find that pretty hard.
Yeah, it is pretty hard. And I think the social part is the hardest part, to be honest. So I think weekdays, if you're working, you know, everyone's like, yeah, we're going for coffee or tea, walks, like nobody's going to know that you didn't have a lunch with them. But I think on the weekends when your kids are whatever, or you're at your friend's birthday party, or I was watching Dune, the movie, and everyone's eating popcorn, and the guy on my left was like, you know, slowly tearing apart that ketchup packet to put it on his hot dog. And I was like eyeballing him hard because I was like, I need this movie to start ASAP because I'm literally like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds from like grabbing the hot dog and like stuffing it in my mouth. You know, anyway, that's the cheap stuff I want. I want a lot of carbs, I'll be honest. It's shocking. I don't want beef. Well, I don't want steak. I don't want whatever. I want a hot dog.
Your body wants to survive, right? That's just, it wants the thing that's easiest to break down and process. And it's, you know, sugar.
Give me that honey wallop bread. Give me that longan syrup. Don't know what recipe. Oh my gosh, I was looking at that stuff so hot. Anyway.
A long time ago, we did this competition at my startup where we all were on a juice fast.
Ooh, yeah. How's that?
So like you could only drink the juices that were delivered.
Yeah.
And of course, given the character of the people involved, not only was there the actual fasting competition, there was a separate betting market on the outcome of the fasting competition, which then led to active sabotage in order for people's bets to win out.
Yeah.
And basically, one of our founders had it set up that if he won the competition, he would win a bunch of money. If he lost and the person he bet on won, he would still win a lot of money.
Oh, that's a nice way of doing it. Yeah, those are some financial instruments in play now.
But yeah, like basically people would order food to the office to try to sabotage specific candidates, you know, like fresh baked cookies in front of someone, or that this one guy, he had a weakness for pasta. So it was like, I think the fourth day, and they sent like this full pasta meal and just laid it out at his desk.
Yeah.
And he was just like, I'm sorry, I'm so hungry. So good.
Yeah. And I think it's a fair point. I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is that the only foods that we're really addicted to these days are like carbohydrates. Body is like, oh, I'm addicted to broccoli, or I'm addicted to steak or chicken, right? It's like, you know, you can't eat that much steak or chicken anyway. And I think when it comes to like all the cakes and tarts and breads, you know, that to me is like ding, ding, ding.
Okay, sorry. We don't mean to torture you. We can stop talking about food.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to talk about Taylor Swift since we both ended up turning up at the same concerts. I mean, we were not on the same night. So we got to see Taylor Swift. So we want to talk about all things Taylor Swift. We want to talk about experience. We want to talk about economics. We want to talk about that Thailand regional rivalry for the business of Taylor Swift and wherever that takes us, I guess. So yeah, Shiyan, how was your experience at Taylor Swift?
I went on the first night. It was, I would say I am not a diehard Swiftie, but I went with my daughter and my mom and my niece. And I was mostly there to just see the spectacle, right, of fandom. And I was not disappointed. Like the amount of effort that people put in to the costumes, the bracelets, the signs, it was awesome to see. Everyone around us, I feel like we were probably like me, my mom were probably on the older end of the audience while, you know, the kids were on the younger end of the audience. But I would say like the bulk of people, I don't know, was what, maybe 12 to 28 maybe would be where I would eyeball the audience. Yeah. And they knew all the words. They knew not just the words, but they also knew a bunch of the hand movements. So even as Taylor Swift is performing on stage, I had a whole row of girls in front of us who were sort of like performing in tandem. And so, yeah, I was just really impressed, right? Like, I mean, growing up in Singapore in the 80s, we did not have a lot of concerts. And I don't think I was as aware of music at that age. And maybe that's like, you know, it's like when you said, oh, we walked uphill in the snow both ways or whatever. But like, we didn't have that many channels. It was before the internet. And so you just didn't have that kind of global fandom. And right in the stadium, it wasn't just local Singaporeans. People had flown in from all over. I just had a meeting today with a Chinese investor who'd flown. I was like, hey, what are you doing in town? She's like, oh, I'm here for the Taylor Swift concert.
Priorities. Priority number one, Taylor Swift. Priority number two, meeting with Shiyan.
But yeah, I was really impressed by the fandom. I was really impressed by her ability to perform so many songs with no break and with a high amount of energetic enthusiasm. And just the marketing genius of it, right? I don't know. Did she say this during her concert? She's like, who here is your first time here? You know, then some people raise their hand and shout, who here, you know, you've seen me in concert before? And then everyone else, right? And she's like, new friends, old friends, I love you all. You know, just this sort of like, you know, and then the storytelling and the chatting with the audience and everything. I just thought it was all really well done.
Yeah. You know, I think it was almost like down to a science, right? Because when I was there, I had the same, I think I'm definitely less of a sweet than you if on a spectrum of there. But my wife was one of those folks who was really into it as well. She knew all the songs and the lyrics and she was like standing up and waving. And so it was kind of interesting because it's like, yeah, you know, to be honest, I didn't know my wife was that much of a fan, actually, to be honest.
How long have you been married?
It's a work in progress. And I would know, like, she likes Rihanna. I know all these other stuff. I know what food she likes to eat. But I guess, you know, it's like she wears the AirPods and listens to something. I'm not, like, super paying attention here for that side, right? It's a private listening experience. But I think it was interesting because I actually went with her to other concerts. So we went to the Ed Sheeran concert, which happened about, you know, 1 to 2 weeks before. We're going to the Jack Johnson concert, which is definitely my thing. And she's definitely not into that thing. So we're trading turns here. So you're seeing a lot of concerts actually during this time frame. And I think my observation of, you know, the entire concert was, I think, first of all, as someone who didn't really know the music, obviously heard the music at various clubs or bars or whatever it is, she is a musician, right? I mean, she does know how to sing. Yep. She knows how to perform. She, you know, she's kind of like what they call like a triple threat or whatever that threat is, you know, in terms of like being able to do all those things. And I, you know, I was watching the whole thing and I was like, I was exhausted by the entire whole concert. I was even the one singing and dancing and moving and choreographing and changing costumes. So I think kudos to her. I think it was a very well-produced show. I mean, it's definitely different from Ed Sheeran. Ed Sheeran is like a single person singing pretty much 90% of the time versus Taylor Swift being a whole ensemble. But you could really see the work, the set design. I think the lights, the music, the fireworks. Yeah, and I think the second thing that jumped out at me, I agree with you, is like the fans. I mean, I was surprised that a row of girls behind me didn't like topple over from hyperventilation, right? You know, she's like at the top and singing. And you know, what's interesting is that the cameras were out the entire time. So the recording or live streaming, the whole thing, maybe all three or four of them, I would say, out of the four of them, for example. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon because, you know, it reminded me like this is one of the concerts where everybody's on their phones as well. Everybody's recording and they knew all the song lyrics and they were hyperventilating and screaming. And I was like, wow, this is a new, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, my dad brought me to watch the Eagles. And it was like a bunch of old folks with the guitars and playing acoustic, you know, and it was a beautiful, I loved it. I mean, Hotel California, it was great, but none of us were on our phones back then. None of us were like videoing in and screaming and, you know, massively singing along. So it's a very different concert experience, I'll say.
You weren't a teenage girl.
I wasn't a teenage girl. Yeah. And, you know, I was actually quite moved. I mean, some of the songs I felt like, you know, I think it's something to do with like, you know, the mass group fever plus great music. And so I didn't know the songs, but I was like, I could feel myself being moved. I was like, yeah, you know, champagne problems. Like, I don't know the song, but I feel it. I feel champagne problems too. You know?
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know. I think teenagehood is a unique period in someone's life, right? Where you're kind of ripe for these obsessive fan relationships with like idol figure. And in fact, I think Job has an article about that this week in this week's edition of the magazine that kind of explores it in pretty amusing detail. But I think it's something that the internet has supercharged, right? I was at a conference last year in Manila called Conquest, where they had all of these VTubers. And someone who has literally spent 0 minutes thinking about VTubers, it was mind-boggling to me to see people go nuts, like thousands and thousands of people go nuts for a persona, not even a person, but a persona.
Define VTuber for those who don't know what a VTuber is, because I think people know what a YouTuber is. I know what a VTuber is, but please explain.
Well, there's people who have presences on YouTube, but not like as themselves, as a character. And people have parasocial relationships with that character. And so even when they're in this conference, they're not there as like Jeremy, right? They're there as their VTuber persona.
Right. Did you get to see the real faces, or were they just like, they're still hiding and they're on screen as the VTuber? Oh, wow. That's interesting.
So, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like these sorts of things and, you know, the whole, all the trappings, right? The merch, like meeting other fans who are enthusiastic about the same thing and having small groups get together to go support all of this stuff. Like it was just fascinating. And the fervor, I think that was the other thing.
Right.
Like it's, I mean, I'm not a music person, right? So maybe like for me, the analog is a sports team, right? Like you can be like a super big sports fan. You follow the games and you obviously, you have no relationship to the outcome, but you feel deeply about it. So it's sort of like, I think, akin to that. But it's interesting to me what the internet has been able to do to really supercharge these audiences and relationships.
And I think there's a whole economy behind it, right? So, you know, I'll talk about it in two ways. But yeah, I think for VTubers, I think the benefit of it is that, you know, you're not tied to an individual employee, you know. So a lot of the VTubers, they're being managed by agencies, obviously, because it takes time to build the models and so forth. Obviously, they're individual VTubers, but many agencies, you know, the truth of the matter is like, you know, if I hire, you know, Cheyenne and Jeremy as individual personalities, the truth is any of us can hive off and become our own brand. And I think we saw that with the New York Times. A lot of them moved to Substack, right? You know, you see that for a lot of tech journalism. They create their own Patreon pages. So, you know, BuzzFeed, I think, is a good example. They were trying to build a lot of individual personalities and they all created their own sub channels. So one of the interesting things about VTubing actually is that, I mean, beyond the benefits of like anonymity and you can take turns and, you know, you don't have to look good and wear makeup or whatever it is to look good on the screen. The truth of the matter is that it's actually a really strong dynamic. And we see that a lot actually as well in like TikTok Shop and a lot of the Chinese live streaming, you know, there's like all the models are being employed effectively by agencies because it's way easier to centralize production, lighting, editing, direction, fulfillment. And then you just have 20, you know, or 30 talents on that cast. So it's a kind of interesting dynamic. And then Taylor Swift is the opposite of that. I mean, she's like super social, right? In the sense that, you know, like, I feel like if I saw her anywhere, I would know who she is, right? Which is a bonkers thing to say because of the internet. And I think the truth of the matter, I was like looking at the people around and I was like, in our generation, well, you know, not to date myself here, but it's like, you know, Britney Spears, for example, was somebody that you could only listen to if on the radio or on TV specifically. And then eventually, I think the MP3 player came up and then a lot of us were pirating software.
LimeWire, baby.
Myself, LimeWire, but not myself, Kazaa and Napster. And that's how like, you know, Britney Spears became famous because it's like everybody just downloaded that tracks. Right? And I think that's your first global star like Britney Spears. But I guess it's interesting that everybody knew who Taylor Swift was. It's a kind of a bonkers superstar phenomenon.
It was amazing. It was amazing. And just like as a business person, you know, that she could take her tour, monetize that, turn it into movie, monetize that.
You know, the
like,
crazy
the
part
merch-
is that the crazy part is that my wife watched the movie and then went to the concert. And I was like, this is the same thing. But it turns out that there's a lot of people who are doing the same thing. They're like, they saw the movie and they're like, you know what? This movie's so good. I'm going to watch the concert as well, which is, you know, like, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting phenomenal because you're like,
she's a genius. She's a genius. Yeah. She took the same thing. She took a product and she like made multiple SKUs. Like but it was crazy to me. Like I got this email that said, oh, if you want to buy merch, you have to like get an appointment. You have to like book a time slot to buy merch. Yeah. And I'm like, huh? My mind was blown.
It's like a scarcity, rarity factor there, right?
I mean, it's totally bonkers. But so impressive. So impressive.
And what was really impressive was, of course, the fact that, like you said, there were so many people who were for the first time, but also people who were from Singapore and people from our town. And it caused that very dramatic, you know, where my friends, even from the US, were like, hey, this Thai prime minister really doesn't like Singapore signing an exclusivity agreement with Taylor Swift. What's going on here? I mean, obviously, you know, it's everybody in the world wants to talk about Taylor Swift. So that's how I think Singapore came up. But I think it's an interesting piece where I think the final number came out that, you know, Singapore paid about, you know, $3 to $4 million for an exclusivity agreement so that Taylor Swift would only perform concerts within Southeast Asia in Singapore. So I think that excludes North Asia or South Asia.
Yeah, she was in Tokyo, right?
Yeah. And so I thought it was really interesting because the interesting part was like there was a very dynamic piece about, you know, what is the ROI? I mean, the competition of tourism is a very big problem or challenge for a lot of economies in Southeast Asia. So here are some quick numbers that we had here was that, you know, based on the estimation was that Singapore bringing in Taylor Swift and Coldplay is expected to bring in about 0.25 percentage points to the GDP in the first quarter. So each Swift goer was spending about $1,400 in the broader economy. And the total spending by the 300,000 concert goers was about $115 million. And so the total tourism receipts are about $350 million to $500 million. So out of that, $75 million was direct ticket sales. And yeah, so $75 million. And then Taylor Swift made about $11 million just from the six concerts. So it's really quite interesting to see some of these numbers economically.
Is that right? I would expect her to make more money than that.
I don't know. I'm quoting this from Nomura, Maybank, Trip.com, and Straits Times. So, but yeah, I mean, I did some basic math as well. I mean, you know, there's about, each concert was about 60,000 people. So times six, that's 360,000 folks. Then the question is, what's the average ticket size price? So yeah, it would be interesting to see how that turns out. But it's definitely in the millions of dollars.
No. The 11 million is retained within the Singapore economy. 85% goes to Swift. That's why I was like, if it's 75 million of ticket sales, she gets the bulk of that. So she gets
about
80
mil for her. Yeah, that sounds about right to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. So I think that's an interesting piece. Okay, sorry. Let me re-clarify. So the total ticket sales was 75 million and 11 out of that, 11 mil goes to the Singapore economy directly. And out of that, 64 million goes to Taylor Swift, which sounds about right.
And that's not including her merch sales or whatever.
Movie sales or people buying and listing more stuff on Spotify and ad rates there. So it's really interesting. I think it's a good deal for the Singapore government, right? I mean, is this saying that if it was a 3 mil exclusivity agreement? Well, Singapore has effectively almost a 10% GST value added tax. So if 300,000 concert goers really spent 415 mil, that means the Singapore government basically earned $40 million. Effectively. So it's a 10x return on exclusivity agreement.
Do that deal all day long.
Do that deal all day long. Keep going. What does the Thai PM think? Just keep going.
Well, but I mean, I think it's probably, I mean, separate from the money, I think it's probably a good deal for her in that she doesn't have to set up and take down multiple places, right?
Sure.
Which would add costs and effort, right? Fatigue, whatever it is, right? You just set up in one place and you perform through and maybe take a break in the middle of the week or whatever it is. It's like a chiller schedule.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think there was also non-financial benefits to the arrangement.
Of course. I mean, what are the others is that, first of all, Singapore continues to be a great hub for hospitality. It's easy to get flights. There's a tourism industry all set up. It's very safe, right? There's no crime. And I think the culture is more accepting of Taylor Swift, a single lady, you know, kind of like letting it loose, I guess. So I think there was a previous concerns. I think we had a concert, right, that was effectively canceled in Malaysia. So there's all kinds of things that can happen, right? Because there's all kinds of like cultural and religious dynamics as well in Southeast Asia. Maybe last thing I'll add is that Taylor Swift did, in the last tour, try to have a concert in Thailand. But unfortunately, she did it. And then there was a military coup that happened. And then she canceled a concert, understandably, afterwards. So I think that's something that was kind of left out in the news was like, if you were to organize a Taylor Swift concert, you'd be like, yeah, this is what happened last time. I mean, things can happen.
No,
right?
No comment.
Well, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it's a fact of the record, whatever it is. But if you were to Taylor Swift organizers, there's a lot of benefits to being in Japan and Singapore, right? Because of also the home economy, GDP per capita, all the various transportation links.
I do feel, though, that if we're going to keep doing this, like be a concert hub or whatever, we need a better stadium. The indoor stadium's acoustics are Mediocre at best.
Yeah, well, on today's news, Singapore just announced they're going to build another stadium. So they have the Singapore Outdoor Stadium, which we watched it at. And then there's the Singapore Indoor Stadium, which has been around for 30 years. And then now they just announced that they're going to build a third stadium. And I think they haven't really decided what they're going to do with the old indoor stadium, but they want to make sure that acoustics are there. So it'll be interesting. I think what's underappreciated is that the Singapore government did take over that area. So previously, I think that area was organized by more of an independent body, and now it's much more directly managed by the government. And I think what's interesting is that, I mean, there's speculation here, but my perspective is that a private entity that was government linked just didn't price in, you know, the ripple effects, the externalities of bringing in these blockbuster acts. So very focused on management and sports. But, you know, from a government perspective is if you can do more, you know, global sporting events, more global entertainment events there, then I think as we saw here, there's a huge economic ripple effect and multiplier effect from the tourism domestic spending into the broader economy, which is, you know, important to keep GDP capita growth. And I don't think that's easily priced in if you're an independent body, but it's much more clearer when the government is directly managing the whole region right now.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have yet to go to the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Ooh, I wanted to go.
But that looks like, I mean, that's like kind of new state-of-the-art type of facility. And, you know, I've had some friends go to, I think U2 performed there and say that, like, you know, the sound is amazing and it's kind of like a crazy experience. So I guess it's good news. You know, it's an opportunity for us to build something more cutting edge and something with better acoustics, at least for Pete's sake, if we're going to host musical acts. I just think the acoustics is an important feature of it.
I mean, I think it just takes a whole team effort to do both, right? Which is like kind of chicken and egg. You need to build venues that are big enough, and then you need to have the tech team football effort to bring in the acts that can actually fill it. And then you need to bring in the tourism work to attract the visitors to come in. I think it's a lot of work. So I think it's a really smart strategy. I think a lot of folks, I just saw like a Malaysian opposition lawmaker ask why Taylor Swift wasn't in Malaysia. So I think a lot of folks are like going through that same. Every government in Southeast Asia is kind of like, okay, you know, hey, that was like $450 million of stimulus. We want some of that, right? I mean, who doesn't want that? So it'll be interesting to see what every government is going to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Taylor effect is real. But when, I think more interesting question is, when do we get our own Taylor Swift, Jeremy? When are we going to have a breakout local star who can have this global audience?
I hate to say this, but I just think it's hard because is this a function of geo-pathing, right? Is this like, what is your city's talent and ecosystem, which is a function of industrial policy, right, but also emergent.
But the Koreans have done it. Huh? There's K-pop stars.
Yeah, I mean, they industrialize the whole studio setup. Yeah, I think so too. I mean, they have a very Americanized point of view. They know how to ship it. It takes work. And I think this entertainment industry, they have a large enough domestic consumption of it, population size as well. I just find it hard to believe personally. I think I was in New York, right? And I was doing improvisational comedy classes. And you know, I think it was just mind blowing because so many people who were in the same class are not just like me, who are like professionals doing as a hobby to explore as a skill. But like one third of the class was flat out within the entertainment industry. They were working on Saturday Night Live. They were working on these comedy shows. And then one third of them was just wanted to be professional comedians, right? And so it was just like a really interesting dynamic where you have these actors and comedians and professionals. But the thing is, there is an entire entertainment industry to absorb them, right? If you're in New York and you're a stand-up comedian and you want to be working on SNL as a producer in the interim or be in a writer's room, it works. I think there's a conveyor belt that's there. And so I think a lot of Singapore talent that we see, I think we can foster early talent, I think, but they tend to go to other cities that have the hubs, right? They've developed. JJ Lin, right? You know, he's out in the Mandopop. Singaporean boy, very popular. I guess he's the Ed Sheeran in Mandarin. That's what I realized. And he's not in Singapore. I mean, he started here, but the only way for his career to succeed was to be more in China and Hong Kong. So it's been interesting to see. Another book I read was Robin Williams. And Robin Williams is a talented guy and comedian. He was really good. And everybody knew in SF that he was really good. But his career only took off in Los Angeles because Los Angeles had the talent scouts, all the clubs, and people were willing to give him those contracts very quickly because it's Los Angeles, right? So I just think it's hard to beat these centers or vortexes of talent gravity. I don't know. What do you think? Are you more optimistic?
I mean, I could argue it both ways, which is that the internet gives people the opportunity to build global audiences earlier than before. And it doesn't really matter where you are if you have the internet. Singaporeans do speak English, which is sort of like a global language, so they could access a bigger market. I do think what you say, though, about talent density is a real thing, right? Which is like, let's say you're very promising, but you're not really surrounded by other promising people. It's hard to hone your craft. Right. So separate from the sort of audience building piece, there's like, how do you even just get better? And that might require you to move elsewhere.
Yeah, so it's a challenge. I mean, I think we see that from Ronnie Cheng, right? Malaysian boy, grew up in Singapore as a student. And then he succeeded in America because that's where he was really spotted. And they were like, yeah, we need an Asian guy to join the show and represent that point of view. and he was spotted. It's hard to beat talent vortexes. I think SF is a good example as well, sucking up a lot of entrepreneurs again now that the pandemic's over. I don't know if you remember, there's a time when pandemic was there and everyone was like, SF is dead, it's over. And now it's like starting to spin that little vortex and now people are drifting back in, right? It's hard to beat.
Yeah. From doom loop to boom loop.
I know. And I mean, obviously it's not a perfect place to live, but if I was single and I want to be a founder, I'd be like, yeah, go to SF, check it out, see if you like it for 1, 2, or 3 years. But you're definitely not moving down into the boondocks, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to beat. These talent vortexes are hard. And I think it goes a lot to the industry. You know, I think it's a lot of it is accidental, but a lot of it also goes back to like industrial policy as well. Not easy.
So what are we a talent vortex for, Jeremy?
Finance is a big one, I'll say. Capital management in Southeast Asia and then capital allocation like VCs, funds. I mean, there's rule of law. There's a strong military defense system to protect that as well. So there's stability politically. So I think there's an interesting piece where then Singapore founders probably get a good set of early stage capital, right? And coaching and talent incubation that kind of like is a lagging effect of the capital side, I would say. Education is a big one. Education vortex is a big one. I mean, people go to Singapore to study. NUS and NTU and SMU are great universities. What else do you have in your mind?
No, I think those are good ones.
I think concerts
Marine,
are.
Shipping.
Concerts are. Shipping. Oil and gas as well. Especially in the refinement, semiconductor, interestingly. I mean, historically, I think it's a bit harder versus Vietnam now, but there's still biotech. I would say Singapore government has done a lot in biotech. Actually, talking about entertainment, I think there is obviously the MICE or conference organizing kind of concert industry as well, hospitality, I would say as well. So these are talent vortexes that you can do well.
My friend is in town for an anesthesia conference.
Wait. Oh, okay. I heard Anastasia, which was like the princess, and I was like...
No, like anesthesia.
Yeah. That's total opposite. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. I saw a conference once. It was called like the fraud conference. And I was so amused by it because you saw people who hunt fraud.
It's a security.
Yeah. And he had a magazine, which was like the fraud magazine. And then the top was like fraud. And then it shows a guy's face or a girl's face as like their person of the, I don't know, month for the publication. And I'm like, it's so funny because again, you're like, you don't read it as anti-fraud magazine. You read it as this person's a fraud. Anyway, that's my dad joke, I guess. But this is a really fascinating to see a fraud conference happening. What was that? Super Returns. So it was a big one that the Singapore Venture Capital Association worked with AGB to pull from Hong Kong for multiple years. So that was a big one as well for the capital allocators and VC funds.
Yeah. I think going back to your comment about what are the positive externalities of some of these events, I think it dates all the way back to F1.
Right. It is a big
F1 one was about, probably like a big one that, and I think F1 probably requires way more investment than Taylor Swift, right? Because you actually shut down the downtown area for the race, but then it had this sort of gravitational pull, right? Because now you have Milken and Super Returns kind of bracketing F1 and turning that kind of 2-week period in Singapore into a big draw for both GPs and LPs globally, actually.
Yeah.
And so that I think is another sort of example of this kind of MICE.
Yeah. Concept. I don't know. I don't even know what MICE means. I think this conference.
I think it's like something conventions and expos.
Tweet Xu Yan angrily for not knowing MICE because I don't know MICE. Why do you tweet at her? But I think there's an interesting piece that you have here. I agree is that, you know, September is totally shot from now on. That's what I realized. Because September is pretty much like but everybody's bracketing that. And one of the interesting schemes that I found out was that in the Economic Development Board or the tourism side is they will actually give you grants if you're able to prove that you're able to get people to stay longer than the time that they were at a conference. So for example, like if your conference was 3 days, but if you can get people to stay an additional 1 or 2 days, you actually get grants from the Singapore government for doing so because there's a stimulus effect, people are traveling, so forth. And so what's interesting is happening is that as a result, every event is starting to tag on in a sequence now. So there's this, September's just getting bigger and bigger because you have F1 as a flagship tentpole. Then everybody's like, it's easy to prove people are going to stay longer. So now these events are all kind of like starting to cluster in this September
time. Oh my God.
It is bonkers.
Token, Milken, Super Returns. Those are like big ones. But then there's all these other things. I think Forbes has one. There's like a music one as well because there's a founder I know who always comes in for the music conference. So yeah, it's pretty intense, that whole sort of like 2.5 week period. And of course, hotels become completely absurd.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because there's a lot of ripple effect, obviously. But boy, it's an exhausting time frame. But you know, obviously, if it makes sense, right? If somebody's flying in from the US, I mean, again, example, they're not going to make that 25-hour flight. You might as well stay for a longer period of time. So you might as well do all
it's
those things.
It's only 14 hours. Come on, man.
Okay, if you do the direct flight, okay. I think they're longer flights. Well, it depends. Okay, wait, you're talking about 14 hours from SF, right? Yeah. I'm talking about New York. This is the
18 and a half.
Okay. Some people go and transit through Narita Airport and have a layover, Shuyen. But still, it's a long flight. That's a key thing here.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
you might as well spend a long time. And it takes you at least 5 days to get over the jet lag anyway, since it's a 12-hour, 8-hour time zone jet lag. Yeah, so yeah, you yeah. might as well stay longer. And I think...
It makes a ton of sense. I mean, that's why we planned Camp Hustle in that period. Yeah. Because we're like, hey, you're already going to be in town for F1. Why not pop over to Bali, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, right? But if there's nothing and I'm like, hey, come to Bali, people would be like, what? That's like so far.
Exactly. And a lot of VC funds actually suddenly moved their annual general meetings into that time frame as well, because they're like, I want to meet my LPs in person. And if I do them in November, for example, well, the LPs already came by in September and then they peaced out. You're like, hey, you want to come back to Singapore again in November? And everyone's like, no. Hey, does that mean there's a bad time to fundraise if you're a founder in September because your VC is running around fundraising from LPs? I'm just talking out loud here.
Probably.
Yeah.
But also, I think it's an interesting thing, right? Because on the one hand, you have incredible concentration of people, right, but they're all having multiple demands on their time.
Yeah.
So it can be, it's like, hey, we're in town. And then you're like, okay, but I have these three conflicting events I need to go to at the same time or whatever it is. So I've seen people pursue various strategies where they use it as top of funnel, but then they stay a week later and then they set up one-on-ones after, once all the like parties have cleared out, or they only use it as like a touch base, but they're not really trying to get like major substantive decisions done in that period. So yeah, I think there's a variety of strategies to approach that period of time because it is so hectic.
Yeah, so hectic. I was exhausted. I remember at the end of that thing, I was like, I'm extroverted out. I was just at home just reading a book. And my wife was like, who is this person? And I'm like, I'm reading a book in bed, quietly, crazy. But I think it's interesting because all these kind of like talk a little bit about the impact of conferences and blockbuster effects, and which is, I think it's interesting because the internet has made like the marginal cost of consumption of content effectively zero, right? If you watch one movie of Taylor Swift online versus someone watches 10 times, there's no cost, additional cost marginally. And then there's this return of the in-person blockbuster events. I don't know, it's kind of interesting to see that happening.
I mean, I guess it's a marginal cost to the producer. It's not a marginal cost to the consumer.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
But yeah, I think we talked a little bit about this, but you kind of have the, what is it? Bimodal distribution, right?
Yeah.
The big get bigger. So the blockbusters, their reach becomes even more vast at a lower cost. But it also allows kind of like neat long tail things to drive because the cost of distribution has been driven down and because people can find their interests more effectively. So you are super into emo, punk, nerdcore. I don't even know if that is a real thing, but you can find it and you can find other people like you who want to find that thing, which you would not have been able to do 20 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. I think my wife and I watched the Bill Burr movie called Old Dads. And super niche, right? I think it was commissioned by Netflix effectively. And super niche, right? Because it could never do well in a cinema in today's age. It's not a blockbuster. Not everybody knows who Bill Burr is. And it makes a lot of jokes about being a dad that doesn't get modern society. And so it's a really niche thing, but my wife enjoyed Bill Burr like podcast episode where he was talking about fatherhood. And so I told her, I said, I think this could be a fun movie to watch. And she and I really enjoyed it. And we would have never been able to watch it on time in a movie theater. And so we enjoyed it, but I'm pretty sure nobody else watched it. And so I think it's interesting where, like I said, the barbelling, this niche content like Bill Burr, and the other end is like these blockbusters like Taylor Swift, where everybody needs to either be there because it's a cultural event, or you're there because your wife or niece is there and is just accompanying them. You have to be there because it's a cultural event like the Super Bowl. And the things that in between is just dying, right? I think your romantic comedies, which I'm a big fan of, your niche stuff, is kind of like dying out as your art house films, for example, as well. They're not going to be in the theaters anymore.
That's so okay. They're all going to be on or whatever other arty distribution channel there is.
I think A24 is doing a good job. I was watching this business analysis of A24 model, but yeah, they're taking a good advantage of this long tail. Like they believe that, well, it's not really long tail, but they're trying to go for one step above. But as a result, they think it's underpriced. But what they do is they go for a lot of bets actually. So it's kind of more of an index bet. So they kind of like find all these like great house directors who haven't made it. And they give them a decent check, honestly. It's actually like an index bet because for them, they don't know which one's going to make it. So it's quite interesting. So I think A24 has obviously brought a lot of the really kind of like, I would say more fresh mainstream stuff. I want to watch Civil War by A24. That's a movie about a civil war in America. But the previous director did Deus Ex Machina, which was a great sci-fi movie. He did Annihilation, which had Natalie Portman, which is another great sci-fi movie. So I was like, oh, interesting that A24 is going after this segment.
I didn't know you were such a movie buff, Jeremy.
I'm not a movie buff. I'm not part of the Stanford Movie Club like my wife. I'm just more of a sci-fi. I like certain directors, I would say. So I like my Alien series, Prometheus, Ripley.
Did you go to Dune?
I did. Oh my God, it was great. So my wife and I watched it. Another great. I mean, I love this guy, Denis Villeneuve. He did Blade Runner 2049. Amazing. Probably the only movie I paid three times to watch that movie, Blade Runner 2049. It was so good. But it was such a commercial failure because it was like people like me who enjoyed Blade Runner 2049. But then I think he learned from it and he went on to build Dune 1, which was a massive commercial success. And then Dune 2, which kind of honestly delivered. Do you watch Dune 2?
So I'm one of these weird people where I actually generally prefer books to movies.
You must consume all of it. The book, the movie, and the concert, right? Taylor Swift doesn't have a book yet, I guess.
So I actually really enjoyed the Dune books. And I think once, like with Harry Potter, I've watched the movies and read the books. I've generally found that I prefer my own imagination. So I don't tend to watch movie adaptations of books I've enjoyed.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I enjoy watching both, actually, to be honest. I used to be more purist, but now I'm just like, if I watch the movie first, I read the books, I get a deeper sense of the character. If I read a book, books first. I think what's interesting is that it's really brought a large audience, because when I was reading Dune, like probably you and I, we're kind of nerdy. Not cool.
Hey there.
Okay, I'm just describing myself. I'm not describing you. But, you know, now it's a movie and I'm like, oh, we're all cool now. We're like, oh. And my wife is like, oh, what's the sequel going to be? And I'm like, yeah, I read the whole Dune series. I know what's going to happen after this movie. I'm not going to tell you. That's the fun part. All right, Dune. Must watch. If you haven't watched it, watch it. And watch Blade Runner 2049.
You can't save it, Jeremy. Stop pushing it.
I'm trying to push the, like, you got to buy it at Amazon Prime or something, or Apple TV or something like that. It's like, it's bad. It's Blade Runner 2049 was just way too into the sci-fi core segment, right? Oh well. Anyway, Taylor Swift plus Dune plus. But yeah, I think they're actually a lot. They're both similar in the sense that Taylor Swift and Dune were both blockbusters and were designed to be blockbusters and distributed like blockbusters. So
yeah. So I guess, do you think generative AI leads to more long tail content? What does it do to blockbusters? It leads to more people being able to build. You know, let's tie it back to technology.
I think you're 100% right. I think it's going to spread out the bimodal piece, which is that the long tails is going to get longer because get nichey, even nicher. Like, okay, let's just say, supposedly, I really like to watch videos of dune sandworms attacking Singapore content. I don't know why I would say that, but let's say I want that. Well, turns out nobody will ever make that for me unless I paid an illustrator to do that as of 1 year ago. But now generative AI can make a video for me. So I think the long tails just get even more fragmented and niche. I think it's the blockbuster like stuff will get bigger as well.
Fanfic on steroids.
Oh yeah. 100% fanfic on steroids. I mean, you know what? That'll be a fun. Yeah, I think it's an endless, never-ending story tale, right? Storybook.
That's crazy. Yeah. Awesome.
On that note, peace out, Cheyenne. It was nice hanging out with you again. And always stay tay-tay.
Thanks, Jeremy.
See you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.